Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of the Mundane Festival Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lamberth. Today is Sunday, June 7th, 2020. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and on Podbean, the host site. If you like this show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts and or Stitcher. Give it a 5-star review. Let everyone know why you like it, because it will make me feel good about myself and most of the life decisions that I've made so far. You can email the show at mundanefestivalpod@gmail.com. Let me know what's on your mind. More importantly, what's on your heart. You can like the show on Facebook. You can follow it on Twitter at Mundane Festival. And you can follow me, your host, the guy talking to you right now on Twitter at Chris Lamberth. This is episode 428. I have a super special return guest. You know her. You love her. Comedian. New podcaster. Liz Mealy. She's got a new stand-up special out called Self Help Me, which you can find on YouTube and wherever you listen and buy music. So I'm going to share that conversation with you in a bit right now. I'm sitting here on my couch recording this intro. I just had a nice breakfast sandwich that I'm trying to fight the itis. If you are a Patreon subscriber, you will know you'll get more of that story whether you want it or not. But right now I'm fighting the itis. I'm recording this intro. This has been an interesting week. In the midst of all the bullshit and the shitstorm of the police brutality and everything going on, old guys getting pushed over by people who are supposed to protect said old guy up in Buffalo. Amidst all that, I see a lot of hope. I'm cautiously optimistic about the change that is starting to take place. On the show, we talk a lot about incremental progress in our careers and getting better at our craft, evolving as artists and people and in whatever field that you're in. And I'm starting to see more of that in this country than I've really seen. I mean, you would think 8 to 10 years ago, seeing Obama become president which was a beautiful thing and something I never thought I would see in my lifetime. You would think we would be building on that, and we are, but it seemed that we've within the last 5 to 7 of them years, we've backslid a lot. But I think maybe just with the advent of, I say this all the time, it could be a drinking game. When I say with the advent of social media and the technology enhancing, you see more of the injustices as well. And I think that's with the vigor and vigilance and diligence of the new generation. I guess you call that Generation Z, and some of my peers and whatever. And these millennials are not standing for that shit anymore. And I do want to highlight that. And I see it. I see it happening. So in that regard, there is some hope where I did not see that before. I'm also seeing a lot of people let things go and let other people go, let literal people go if they're not righteous about their shit. If you can't, because this is a time where you have to pick a side, and the people that are on the other side of us progressing, of everybody progressing and evolving, they're getting left to the wayside, and they have to figure that shit out on their own. And it's really not that hard. It's like when you do paint by numbers. People are telling you where to fill in, where to color this shit in. a lot of people are telling people, hey, if you color this in, you'll get the right thing. If you use this formula, you'll get what it is that everybody else is working towards. So I wanted to highlight that because it's easy. Easy. It's always easy to talk about what ain't right. But sometimes I'm really blown away by what I've seen from people that I wouldn't expect to see stuff out of. People, the Facebook post, the people doing the work on the, like, feet on the pavement. So that's a beautiful thing I'm seeing. And on a much, much lighter note, I mean, that's something that I've really appreciated seeing in the past week. Other than doing TPS reports all week and getting over some humps that I was stressing about, I was able to do that. And my weekend was pretty boring. And I don't mind that. What did I do? I wanted a burger yesterday, and I was saying to myself, well, I got burger stuff in my fridge. I just don't have any meat. And I was like, oh, I gotta pick up a prescription at CVS. I'll go to, there's a Whole Foods right by the CVS. And I was gonna go to the Whole Foods, and there were people wrapped around the building. And I said, I guess I'm not going to Whole Foods. So I just decided that I went to Five Guys, and that shit was on point. What else? It was a very pleasantly uneventful weekend, I would say. When I talk about positive shit too, y'all get a kick out of this. If you've listened to this podcast long enough, I'm seeing my girl, my boo, Selena Gomez, with 179 million followers. She's posting about Black Lives Matter and Black activists, and I'm really proud of Selena, and I feel even safe about loving her and her music, and I'm feeling good about that. Like, I see this picture, she posted a picture of herself. She did this really, I guess, hot selfie on May 17th. A series of like four just like cute pictures of her, kind of one, the main picture was her with her lips all pouty and stuff. And then the next post, which was on May, which was 7 days ago, probably like June 1st, posting about Black Lives Matter. And like, she started going in and sharing artwork from black artists and trying to figure out what to do. And she's posted pictures of, you know, one of the co-founders of Black Lives. And she's on her shit. So not only does she have one of the best albums of the year, at least one of the best pop albums of the year, now she's on her woke shit. And so y'all can't say nothing about her no more. I know y'all was on her a few years ago about some, like, bullshit that she said, and I was like, I was like, hey, you don't know the whole story. She's giving money to UNICEF. she was on the ground floor with the hugging the babies and kissing them and shit. So she's doing her thing. So I'm happy for Selena Gomez. I'm proud of you. I see you, Selena. I see you. And when I get my status up, when I get my game right, I'm gonna come at you if you want. All right, let me just not talk about Selena Gomez. What else? Oh, also, like, this week, So like I said, I was not out protesting. I was donating money to get people bailed out if they happened to get arrested. So I did do that. I can actually. Is it too much for me to go into my timeline and give you? Shit! I didn't know that I was going to talk about this. Oh boy, I was going to tell you I think the Minnesota bail fund already has enough. I donated to some place. You can look at my Twitter timeline from the last week and get that info if you follow me on Twitter. I've posted where to donate if you feel so moved to do that. This week TPS reports. I did laundry that I actually have to hang up. I did some laundry. Got to do some more this week. And so Thursday, so I did my laundry on Thursday, and I said, I'm going to go get a burrito. My favorite new burrito place is this place called Tito's Burritos, and I guess a Jersey chain. And I think they got maybe four or five locations. So the one that I went to, I had them DoorDash me some. I was like, okay, this is good. I don't have to go all the way to Montclair to get a good burrito. Because my favorite burrito place, my favorite Mexican spot, they closed down, and it was across the street from the jail. And they closed down, and they moved somewhere 20 minutes away. They opened up another restaurant. Doesn't exist in this place. By the jail doesn't exist anymore. It's the best Mexican food that I've had since I moved here 12, 13 years ago. And I said, let me try Tito's Burritos. I've been following them on Instagram for a couple years, never went. And I had them DoorDash me a couple weeks ago. And I was like, oh, this is all right. So I said, let me go up there. So I'm driving to Ridgewood, New Jersey, which is like 15 minutes away from me. And as I'm driving, I'm seeing a lot of people. I'm seeing a lot of people not wearing masks out. I see a bunch of kids, like, it's summer. Like, you kind of, like, I've been isolating myself. I've been sheltering in place for these past 3 months, only going out when I need to go out, only going to places when I need to go, like the grocery store, the gas station, the pharmacy, those essential businesses that they told us to go to. And really, that's all that I've been doing. And then just to see all these people, it's like, yo, this shit is not over, dog. Like, it's not. And I'm seeing these kids with no masks, and they're going around. And this is, you start to get, like, the further north you go in Jersey is like this, where the more of the wealth is, and to a certain degree. And Ridgewood is one of those wealthy towns or townships, whatever they call these places in New Jersey. And it's nice. And they have their downtown area where they have their little shops. And then there's this church. And I'm driving by this church. I do see people with masks, and they have signs up, and they're like, they're saying Black Lives Matter. And not that many black people in that group of theirs. And there's elderly people saying Black Lives Matter. These people are out and they're saying it. And so I was like, damn, wow, you got, okay, this is dope. So I just honked my horn and I went and got a burrito. And drove away. But when you talk about progress, that was some of it. And there were kids out there with that. And it was like, you know, it did kind of give me hope. You know, that was one of those moments. And the burrito was good. I actually got a quesadilla and a burrito. I did not eat them in the same sitting. I actually ate the quesadilla and had the burrito a couple days later, just made it a breakfast burrito. And it was actually pretty good. My stove is not working. And I like to, my stove, I love warming stuff up in my oven. So the stovetop is actually working. The oven does not work at all. And this is going to be a long episode. I'm sorry, guys. Whatever. You're not paying for this. What are you doing? Maybe you're at work. I don't know. Whatever. Joe Rogan's podcast is like 4 hours long a week, and Spotify gave him $100 million. So you can listen to me talk about my fucking oven, and then I'll bring you to Liz. All right. So that's where I very seldom use the microwave. Before my oven broke, I wouldn't even use the microwave unless I was warming up some veggies or something. And a lot of times I warm veggies up in the oven too. But anyway, I was like, all right, I'll put it in the microwave. And it actually turned out to be pretty good. But my oven is not working. And so my landlord comes over and he's like, oh, it's shot. You have to. And he actually had to fix my sink, too, because my sink was clogged up. And he was just complaining the whole time. It's like, dude, I understand that you work hard, but it's like every time, like that's why I try not to bother him. Before I called him, I got one of those like wire, those deep plunger things. Like you stick the wire down and you can like, it's like a clamp and then you pull it up, you pull like whatever's clogging, like whether it be hair or some kind of gunk. I bought one of those from Amazon, tried to use it. It didn't work. So then that's why I called him. And he's just complaining about how hard his job is and everything. It's like, dude, could you just fix my shit? So he's telling me he's got to get me a new oven. I don't know why I brought that up, but whatever. Like I like warming stuff up in the oven. This burrito that I had, I warmed that up in the microwave, and it was actually still good. So yeah, I got two meals out of that trip to the. I try to be efficient when I do takeout stuff, if I'm not just getting like one thing. If I order DoorDash or something, it's got to be for like maybe at least two meals. So that's what I've been trying to do. But that was a very heartwarming thing to see in a place in New Jersey that I didn't think that I would ever see that happen. If you're black and you listen to the show, it's one of those really nice areas that if you're black, you don't feel comfortable really being there, even though you know you can be there because you're a free because you're a free man or a woman. You know, you feel like you can be there because you have money to spend and you want what this area has as far as like merchandise or food or something. So you just go there. But at the same time, at the back of your mind, there's like that double consciousness where it's like, this is kind of, you know, you kind of feel weird. At least that's how I feel sometimes when I'm in neighborhoods like that. And you definitely don't want to be in that neighborhood at night if you're black. I feel that way, even though it's close to the highway. It's not even that far from where you live. It's just that's how I feel that way about that area. And then the area is kind of diverse too, because when I went in to get my takeout, there was a black kid working there, and it looked like there was a Latino kid and some white kids there and working. One thing they don't do is they don't take cash. Like, we don't take cash. You pay us. You give us your credit card on this call and your food. Like as soon as I opened the door, I was like, pick up for Chris. There's like, it's right there on this little table. And sure enough, it was. And I took my shit and I left. I don't know. I'm rambling too much. I'm going to get you to Liz. Liz is a pal of mine. I really enjoy talking to her. I like shooting the shit with her. We actually really got into talking about current events like off the rip. And we talked about her special later on in the conversation. But it's just one of those really fun and interesting conversations. She said, I'm just going to give a teaser. Rod from the Black Guy Who Tips is going to be on later in this week. I'm going to probably push that out to you guys later on in the week. If you're on Patreon, that episode's already going to be up. But I had this conversation with Rod. I feel bad because it's like me being a man. Rod and I were talking about something, and Rod compared almost everything, and the things kind of seeing like if you're on a ship and you kind of see the branches in the sea, like that means you're getting closer to land and you feel like things are, you know, are breaking in our favor a little bit. And Rod and I joked about that, and he said, well, you know, this is kind of like the Me Too movement. And I was like, oh shit, you're right. You're right, dude. You're absolutely right. And Liz was saying the same shit like a few days earlier, and it didn't blow my mind like it did when Rod said it. I don't know what that was, but when you're able to listen to both those conversations, you'll get it. Cause I was listening to Liz and I talk while I was running errands, and I was listening to this conversation. I was like, oh shit, Liz said the same shit that Rod said. But just in a different way. So, And I didn't really latch onto it like I did when Rod said it, but that's just me being scatterbrained for a little bit. But I really love talking to Liz, and I think her, I said it to her, you know, this is her best work, and it's showing the evolution of a comedian that, you know, you guys have hopefully become a fan of with her being on this show and her probably being on Three Guys On, and just it's really fun to watch her growth and her evolve as a comedian and all of that good stuff. So if you have the time after listening to this and you want to laugh and you want to see somebody that's at the top of her game, check out Liz Mealy in Self Help Me on YouTube and wherever you listen to music. That's enough of me blabbing. So here it is, me and the very lovely and talented Liz Mealy.
I gotta go.
So you're not taking into any of the black guys that you dated. You're just like, fuck them all. They ruined it for you. They ruined it for you.
I don't know if you knew me. After like it was like one of my favorite jokes. I was actually looking for footage of it like maybe a couple of months ago.
Uh-huh.
But like one of my favorite jokes was after my ex-boyfriend dumped me 10 years ago. And I literally just go, I just got dumped. My ex-boyfriend was black. And I remember entering the relationship not being racist.
I think I remember that joke. I think we were on the same show. We were at Phoebe's room. Shit. Oh, I just talked about that room last week. Manchester Pub. I just remember being on a show with you, like, talking shit about black dudes.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think I left that way. Like, it was one of the first times that, like, my darkness didn't, like, got acknowledged exactly the way I wanted it to be. Like, clearly tongue-in-cheek, but also, like, I always wanted to have a joke about, you know, what about when you date interracially and it affects your policies.
Oh, sure.
And it was like, I think that's one of the few old jokes I have that I'm still proud of.
No, it's a good joke. It's a good, you've always been, what I like about you, and there's not that much that I like about you, but I know.
But what I, statement.
But your comedy, it's like how I feel about Louis C.K. Like, I like his comedy. I don't like what he did. You know, I'm fucking with you. Cause you're very personal, and like you talk about your life on stage. So it makes it that stylistically, that's just something that I like. And that's why I'm always drawn to, you know, I always like to check out what you do. So that's what I appreciate about it, you know? So have
Thanks,
you,
buddy.
Oh yeah, pal.
I know you don't like giving me compliments. So that really actually means a lot.
Yeah, it does. We're gonna get into it, but like, how are you doing? How's everything going with you? In spite of, I mean, I've been asking everybody what their life's been like.
I don't know. It's like, I mean, it's funny. I was texting my friend Maria. She's out in London, but she's American.
Mm-hmm.
But I literally was like, I've been in therapy for almost 9 years. And I used to have really bad mood swings. Like some of it I think was because of birth control and just in general makes you crazier. But I also just didn't know how to express myself. And I was always bottling stuff in. And I'm not exaggerating. Like I could be like giddy and then also crying and then rageful. Like in a given day, I was just erratic. And it's taken both not being on birth control, but also lots of years of therapy to really express myself and learn to be, even just to label my emotions. Like it's taken me years to acknowledge just how my base level of anger is bigger than most people's base level of anger. Like I'm just an extremely angry person, but I've done so much work to not be that person. I don't really have mood swings as much. I'm not, yes, I get angry, but I don't act on them. I would say the base of me is still the same, but the inability to control those emotions or how it affects other people has changed a lot. And I would say the last couple of months, it's It's not nearly as bad, but I don't know how I feel every day. And one day I will have trouble getting out of bed and just completely, honestly, depressed. And then next days I feel like I'm going to make it work and this might be a blessing. And then, you know, the next day I'm just like, I don't know how to be a person or how to help others. And I feel like I'm not doing enough. And then the next day I'll just be ready to help everyone and like on the phone and almost like starting a meeting. Like it's, I just feel all over the place. And I, every single day feels different.
So even before the pandemic, even before quarantine, you kind of just been feeling like that?
No, I would say it's mostly in relationship to quarantine. Okay. And yeah, like I said, is like as a person, I kind of understand what I'm going through because I was like this, you know, 5 to 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But I feel like, you know, keep in mind the difference, my life now compared to my life a couple of months ago, I knew I was going to make money. I knew where I was working. My schedule was pretty much planned out at least 3 months, if not 6 months in advance.
Yeah.
I didn't have to worry about finances. I didn't have to worry about my friends' finances. I didn't have to worry about my safety. I didn't have to worry about the safety of my friends and family, as well as the financial needs of friends and family. You know, with you know, the protests and Black Lives Matter, you know, New York didn't have a curfew. Like New Jersey had a curfew, which is where my parents are, but yeah. New York didn't have a curfew. Not that I mean, it's kind of funny. I'm not with my boyfriend right now, but he was like, did you get home in time for the curfew? I was like, I've been home since 2 p.m. Like, and that was just to get a beverage. Like, I mean, I haven't been, not only have I not been out past 7, but a friend of mine asked me to do this kind of like a show where you go to a studio and you perform on Zoom. So it'd be like a small studio with 3 people and blah, blah, blah. And he asked, and it was in Brooklyn. He's like, would you be comfortable doing that? And I go, when is it? And it was like 8 o'clock, and it was like, it would have been a 45-minute train ride. Mm. And I was like, man, I haven't been on the train in like 3 months. I've been on it a couple of times and I just don't feel comfortable on it during the day, by the way, like not even at night. And then I don't feel comfortable. Like there's no protection of people. This is even just, you know, pre-protest, like there's no protection of people being out. So, you know, what made me feel safe walking home after gigs at 2 a.m. isn't really there anymore because no one is out. Right. And I just don't feel safe. And so then you add the layer now of like protests and riots and looting. Like I, as a person that literally used to be an independent woman, night person, you know, out every single night, into the morning, my life is a shadow of what it was before. And the problems I had or what I wanted to do or what I was going to do, like literally nothing looks like it did before. And I don't know my purpose. And, you know, I've been joking that I'm a stay at home comedian, but I am almost not even a comedian anymore. Like there's no way that I would have thought my life would look like this even a couple of months ago, let alone years ago. And that can be emotionally and mentally, I don't say traumatizing because that's not fair, especially with all that's going on right now, but it is disorienting.
But I would say it's still relative to what you're going through. It doesn't mean that you're not aware of what's going on outside of yourself, but internally, if that's what you feel, I mean, I think you know, it's okay to acknowledge that, you know. I don't think, you know.
Yeah, I think the biggest struggle right now for me is, you know, you want to be an ally, you want to be in a position of helping others for change. I think I'm even struggling with the fact that a year ago I had 7,000 Instagram followers and now I have 50,000, and people see me as somebody that has influence. And that's something, you know, I've been doing what I've been doing for 18 years, and only in the last year has anybody ever paid attention. Mm-hmm. And now people don't understand that. They don't understand that I've actually spent more than half my life doing what I'm doing. And I never, not to say I didn't believe in myself, but I never really prepared for what my life would look like if people were watching.
Mm.
And the responsibilities you have when people do watch. So, and I say that for not just in a supporting the people I care about in the Black community. I'm talking about just blatantly expressing myself and being like, fuck, you're fucking an asshole. Leave me alone. Like, even that can come back. If somebody is harassing me, how do I respond to that person? What do I, you know, what am I, how am I supposed to handle this? Not as Liz Mealy, but as a performer, you know, travels the world, other people listen to me talk Liz Mealy. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, it does. I mean, I'm seeing celebrities deal with that a lot now. Like, I mean, Seth Rogen, you know, he went off.
Awesome. Yeah. Though. Like, I saw a girl just pointing out him telling people to fuck off. And I was like, I wish I had a job. I wish I was rich and like, you know, my 50,000 to his millions of people doesn't allow me to go tell people to go fuck themselves.
Yeah. I mean, I even saw John Boyega. It was on from Star Wars. He's over in the UK and he was at a protest and he was just like really just very impassioned and very like he broke down crying and he said, I might not have a career after this, but I don't care. You know, yeah. But I think he'll be okay. I mean,
yeah. I mean, also what to me, like, this is the part that's, I think, the most difficult for me is you don't want to be a person that's defensive because it never reads right. Mm-hmm. It's that same, like somebody says something fucked up and they go, I have Black friends. And you're like, cool, Sarah. Cool. So I never want to be that person, but yeah. It is hard innately to be like, you don't fucking know me. And you've put me in a box because you looked at one post and like a video of mine. So it's really hard when like somebody promoted my special, like somebody was like, I loved it. And I reshared it on Instagram and some white lady, and it really is a stereotype. Some white lady goes, is this really the time to be promoting your stuff?
A Karen?
What I want to,
did a Karen yeah, do that? Well,
I mean, what's funny about it is I get called Karen all the time. And I'm like, hey, I already have a white lady name. At least use my white lady name to make fun of me.
Yeah.
But like, to me, what's upsetting about that is, first of all, why am I not allowed? Like, I don't have a job. I have zero income coming in. Am I just supposed to stop being a person because of the world that's going on? Or are people not supposed to go to the grocery store? Are they supposed to cease living? Like, that's the thing is, like, because I have a frivolous job, people are like, you can't, anything you do that has to be job related, you're a bad person. And you're like, what the fuck? And then I want to be like, do you know my entire community is people of color? My entire community is like, it's like, you want to just be like, I had a woman that was upset about a line in one of my Jewish jokes about my boyfriend being Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And she was very nice about it. I'm not angry about how she approached it because she was very nice. But I was like, yeah, everything I could say could hurt somebody's feelings. Everything. I mean, what am I going to do? Like, it just gets to the point where you feel a little bit trapped where everything you do is wrong. And I even feel that way with the Black Lives Matter movement that's going on right now. Like, they had a whole thing go on that you're like, you're supposed to put up black boxes and show your solidarity.
That was a shit show. That was a shit show from the jump.
But doesn't that feel like it was them not thinking clearly? And then they started blaming white people for doing it wrong when you're like, hey, man, I'm not going to criticize how you do a movement, but you're now criticizing people that were trying to be supportive because it backfired in some kind of algorithm way. And that I wanted to be like, but like, I can't tell you how many people in my feed were like, guy, you're erasing stuff. And what are you doing? And why don't you fucking do research before you just jump on a movement? And you're like, Hey,
yeah,
like, come on. Like, basically you're wrong. If you don't, you're wrong. If you do. And that's why people get tired. And my whole thing is like, you can't hurt me because I've been supportive of my friends and family my whole life. Like, there's nothing about me posting anything about Black Lives Matter that seems like a risk to me, because it's like, if you don't feel that way, I don't even understand how you follow me as a comic. Like,
yeah,
why would I want you in any aspect of my life, even in fandom? I do worry sometimes, as being a vulnerable person, in the sense that up until the pandemic, you would know where I am every single night. Like, there's, you know, I'm the easiest person to find.
Right.
And that's scary for me. And I've always known that. And there's a vulnerability as a woman, as somebody that works at night and somebody that travels for a living. But that being said, to me, sticking up for anything I believe in doesn't feel like a risk, because that's who I am. And my whole stand-up is who I am. Like,
yeah,
that's, but again, you have people that just met you 2 weeks ago because they watched a YouTube video, and they're now telling you you're not being you enough.
Yeah, that's what you and it seems like you and JL Covan are going through that right now. Like, JL had that, his Trump video blow up, and he's got thousands and almost like close to 100,000 followers on Twitter, and he's like getting all this success. And then you see like people like saying, you know, trying to shit on his Trump impression and saying a certain other person is better when that person is doing something else that's not what he's doing. And it's just this weird, it's a weird thing that once you cross over or you get to that next rung in show business that you always, you might have dreamed about it, you might have thought about it, or you may have never thought you would get to that rung, and you get there, and it's the air is a little different, and it takes some time.
Yeah.
It takes some time to adjust. I haven't gotten there yet, but I notice it in a lot of friends that I have and stuff, because I could still, like, I'll get people, I saw you on that TV show for 5 seconds. I'm like, yep, that was me. And the residual,
and you're in character. That's not even, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Then people interpret you differently because the first impression they have of you is as a character.
Right. Right. And so it's a different thing. And I feel like, you know, like I just put out an EP of my stand up, and that was me in a different way. Like, that was the most, the most personal thing that I've ever done. And so I've always looked to you and a lot of people in my circle of people that I talk to, especially in stand-up, where you guys did it on your own. Like, I'll talk, like, you, JL, Randolph, Andy, Tim, you know, like, you guys, I put it on CD, baby, I'm doing it myself. This is my material. I want the money to be mine.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it's investing in yourself. So you and I have had numerous conversations about what do I do when I wanna, and I'll probably hit you up like when we eventually get back to some form of normalcy and I do a full, you know, full hour. But yeah, it's hard. That is hard to deal with, because you've been the same person you've always been. But then other people get to know you, like they find out about you, and because they like you for doing one particular thing, they feel like they have this ownership over you that you can't. Go ahead.
And they feel like you've let them down, and you're like, how have I let you down? What did you build up for me to be to let you down? Because I'll tell you this, I've had the same friends between 10 and 20 years. And I'm not saying I've never let down a friend, but the difference between a friendship and a fandom is I've built up all this trust and all this belief, and these people know 100% my intentions.
Right.
That if I make a misstep, we're talking about a baby step back with a lot of leniency, as opposed to, you know, this is, you met somebody in line at the bank, and then they hurt your feelings and they're like, fuck that guy. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he seems cool at the bank, but clearly he's horrible. Like, you know what I mean? And there's some people that have been fans of mine for years, and I don't want to negate that. And I have tons of people that are wonderful to me, but it does feel like I said, this burst of fandom has been only in the last year. Mm-hmm. And I have people discovering me every day on Instagram and YouTube and what have you. And, you know, they hear, you know, some people become fans because they heard a 2-minute bit. And then next thing you know, they're talking about how they can't support me. And you're like, well, what way were you supporting me before? Like, I just don't know.
Is it because you said something about Black Lives Matter? Or like,
oh,
something?
No, I did a joke. I did a math joke and I used the word rape in it. And I lost a bunch of followers from that. It was like a tweet that I put on Instagram. And it was a bad day, because it was, I had a bunch of personal stuff going on that day. And then my brain is so morphed to comedy and broken that I was like, I didn't even think anything could go wrong with it. I was like, it's a really thoughtful joke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a joke about math. And it was not perceived like that. I mean, I had tons of people that like truly were like, I'm a rape victim and I love this joke. And then I had people that were like, I'm a rape victim and this is horrific and demoralizing. And you're just like, and truly I'm like, I don't think you read the joke right. Like, but then that's my fault. But then you can't always predict how people are going to interpret stuff based on their own personal experiences.
Right.
And I'll say this, not to be defensive of it, but I think if it was done in the middle of a set where somebody knew me and knew my intentions, it wouldn't have been received as poorly as text on an Instagram of a person that you followed because you heard a cat joke. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So I also get people being kind of hit in the face with it, but I never took it down. Like, I had tons of fans leave. I was inundated with messages both of support and, you know, I could never support you ever again. And I actually had some really good conversations with people that even when they said, hey, I still can't be a fan, we still came to an understanding of why I thought it was appropriate.
I would just say, okay, I'm just not the comic for you. All right, peace.
And that's essentially in some ways, I did say that. I go, this is the thing I still struggle with. Like, I do have jokes about rape. Now, the perspectives I have even in my special are I'm scared of it. And these are situations that I've been put in where I don't think people understand the fear of it. And that even that math joke that I put on Instagram and Twitter is still of that perspective, but it wasn't interpreted that way. And
what's the joke? What's the joke?
I have to read it because I don't want to butcher my own thing, but I go, my roommate is learning trigonometry and geometry, and hearing him talk about it is so triggering. Like, he might as well just be saying he's studying rape and rape. It's like, some of us were hurt by math, Chris. And so for me, it's actually talking about just hearing about it. And the like, if somebody's talking about math, it's triggering me the same way that I've had friends tell me about their rape experiences, and it's extremely upsetting. You feel horrific, and it puts you back in places where you've been in that position, and it's hard. And to me, the joke was about the fact that, and you know, I'm not saying what they're saying is wrong, and that's how I talked to most of them. I was like, how you feel isn't wrong, but saying I can't talk about it is wrong to say, because they're basically saying you should never joke about rape. And I go, how is that fair to anybody else's traumatizing experiences? Somebody slowly starves to death because their country doesn't have any food. But we joke about starvation all the time.
Yeah.
We joke about war zones all the time. We joke about genocide. Like, and you could be like, well, I would never laugh at that. But people have. And I think you should literally be able to joke about anything. And actually, by talking about it more, actually puts it in the zeitgeist more and understands how prevalent of a situation and how big of a fear it is. And I'm not saying you should like my joke. I'm not saying you should find it funny. And I'm not saying it's for everybody. But to tell me that this one topic is more traumatizing than other people's trauma,
mm-hmm.
is, to me, you're ignoring everybody else's trauma. And that goes, and that can be linked back to Black Lives Matter, where if you don't talk about it, if you don't let people say, like, you know, I've posted about it and I'm getting comments that are like, you know, well, why are people rioting now? They're not just rioting now. Are you insane? Like, you know what I mean? Like, you didn't listen to the kneeling. You didn't listen to previous riots.
Right.
You know, you didn't listen to everything that's happened before. And this is what it moves down to when you can, you know, it's like a cat, you know, is like hissing, and you keep aggregating it, and then it's biting you, and you're like, what the fuck? And you're like, yeah, you didn't read all the signs. Like, now we're going to attack. Like, to me, it's like, that's just logic. But if you don't talk about these things, and I'm not saying everybody should be, you know, telling horrible, awful, graphic rape jokes. That's not what I'm saying at all. I think there's always going to be a level of delicacy and thoughtfulness that goes into trigger words as well as taboo topics. But that being said, when you say something cannot be talked about, even when it's uncomfortable and even when it's scary for some people, you literally start to erase the history of it. And comedy actually has a lot of ways of making things relevant. Just look at Michael Che's joke that's going viral right now about Black Lives Matter. His joke is an old joke about how it's Black Lives. It's actually a brilliant joke where he goes, Black Lives Matter. We're not even asking. We're just matter. He's like, how far down are we on the negotiating table that we're just asking to matter?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's so, and he just says matter in different inflections over and over again. It's so simple and so well done. And then you have, Chris Rock's joke that's even older recirculating about how there can't be some careers just can't have bad apples. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's no bad apple pilot. So you have these old jokes making relevancy that are hard topics. We're talking about police brutality. You're going to pretend police brutality and losing loved ones and people of your community and parents and sons and daughters isn't traumatizing?
Liz, they want you to talk about cats. You're the cat. You're the cat comic.
I know. I'm disappointing people.
So shut up and talk about cats. You have to talk about cats.
But you know what's upsetting? My cat jokes never take off on the internet.
I don't know.
They never go viral.
But that's
if you start making my cat jokes viral, I'll start writing more cat jokes, people.
But that's the job, though. That's what they pay us to do. And that's what you earn your money. You get paid to do that high wire act of talking about difficult things and filtering it down and trying to make it funny. And you did. Yeah. You got 2,645 likes on there. So people liked it, you know. It's an interesting joke. It's good. I think maybe you've talked about dyslexia and stuff before in conversations, and just knowing you that you have it. And then I wouldn't have known about the math until right before our call. I watched you at a dyslexia association thingy.
Conference,
and what was that, like 2015?
Yeah.
I was just stalking you on YouTube, and I was like, oh, this is pretty neat. And I was like, oh, yeah, I hated math, too. Like, it was just ingrained in my head that one time I was a kid, and my mom was like, maybe he's just not good. He's not good at it. And I was like, fuck, I'm not good at math then. So that's my Achilles heel. Everything else I'm pretty good at, honor student and whatever, but then math is just always kicks me in the ass. And I had that for my whole life until I was about maybe 20, 21 years old in undergrad. I had this, I'll never forget her, Rosemary Heilman, who was my math teacher. I had like remedial math. You had to like test out of it, and I didn't test out of it, so I had to take the class. And she got me out, and I tested, I passed, and then I had to take another math class, which was essentially like, it was FST, like function, statistics, and trigonometry. And I think I got like a B- or a C. And my mom, when she saw my report card, she was like, a C? I was like, yeah, I earned it, and I don't have to do it ever again. You know, like, but she got me through that class. And I, without a calculator, there were parts that you couldn't use a calculator with, and I got through it. But for so long, and I use math. I just logged off working from home using math. So, and I use it a lot in my job. So it's just like stuff like that can cripple you and stay with you. So being a comedian is the way that you do it, which is the way that I like to see it done. Is you're dealing with your issues, you're grappling with them, and you put it out there. And if people don't like it, they don't like it. It's fine. There's other people that'll like it, you know?
Yeah. I think in some ways, I'm just a sensitive person, and I am very empathetic and appreciate that in other people. It sounds very cheesy, but I did get in comedy to spread joy. And when I hurt people, even when it's unintentional, and it makes me sad. It's never my intention. I am always of the camp that you can joke about anything. Anything can be funny. And if it misses the mark, that sucks. or it wasn't for you. Mm-hmm. But I don't, but that's not how comedy is interpreted right now. It's very much this black and white camp of you're a bad person if you do anything that hurts people. And you're like, hey, I'm not saying that you should be ignorant to how you might hurt people, but you can't go around tiptoeing in every conversation and everywhere you go because someone might get emotionally hurt.
Right.
Now, I do think emotionally hurting people has long consequences. I mean, we're talking about police brutality with the Black Lives Matter movement, but there's also the crippling effects of, you know, I forget what the term is, like when people are passive aggressive racist. There's like a term for it. Microaggression. That's what it's called.
There's microaggressions. There's gaslighting. Like, it's just like this mental judo that goes on every day on social media when somebody says something and they don't understand why they said it. It's like Drew Brees. LeBron James just got, I guess, dunked on Drew Brees an hour ago as we're recording, where Drew Brees still thinks you're disrespecting the flag if you kneel. When Colin Kaepernick had a vet tell him that kneeling is a sign of deference and respect, and Drew Brees still just doesn't understand. And LeBron James was like, I had family members that fought in the war, and they understand, they're not offended by it. So why, Drew Brees, are you a football player? How come you can't understand that? So it's just, it's like this deep seated. It's just like I said, like last week on the show, like it's just ingrained within the DNA of this country. It's if you think back on how the police force was set up, it's set up to protect white people's property and to literally police black people. And that's it's weaponized. Like when the woman the Cooper girl, Amy Cooper, tried to sic the police on that black dude.
Christian Cooper, and has nobody talked about how confusing that is?
It is.
And they have the same last name.
Probably related somewhere through slavery. You never know, but you know. And it's just it's one of those things, because she knew what she was doing. She knew what she was doing.
100%.
Yeah. So
100%.
So it's just things that it's a lack of. So that structurally needs to change. That's a systematic thing that needs to be changed. And then what we need to, and then I'll finish. We just need to have more empathy. I think with the with the advent of social media. It's like, because I grew up in the Catholic Church. Like, I grew up Christian. I have, like, parents grew up, like, Baptist and everything. And my dad converted to Catholicism. I went to Catholic school. And you could say what you want about the I don't go to church anymore. But you could say what you want about. There's the pedophilia and all that. That's obviously fucked up. But I mean, it's like it did teach me to treat people with respect and have empathy for my fellow person. I mean, I had parents that reinforced that initially, and then that's what went through in school. And I'm not perfect; I fall short of that. But it's easy for me to have empathize with George Floyd, because that could happen to me. Like I have a bit about that. You know, but like it could literally happen to me. I have had issues with cops and stuff, and I'm a fucking square. You know what I mean? So it's just what it is. So for people to not have that empathy, it's frustrating. It makes you sad. It makes you angry, because I'm here. I pay taxes just like everybody else, bro. You know?
Yeah.
And you want to be treated the same. And so, and then with social media, everybody feels like they're a celebrity and they're not doing shit. They're not like you writing jokes and trying to get booked on shows and honing your craft. They're just somebody that's just kind of like a normal person that doesn't have the skills that you have, that thinks that they're better than you. Oh, everybody's a critic.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks everybody's the master of their page. You're the curator of our own world and what we want people to see. But when the shit hits the fan, like it's been for the last week, I mean, that's kind of how you see who people really are. And, you know, there's like this that really great story that I've been retweeting every time I see something about it. This guy in D.C. who was a homeowner, has his apartment. There were some kids protesting. He brought them into his home and had them stay over because the cops were trying to get them. And that was crazy. And he like ordered pizza for them. And he, you know, it's on my timeline, you guys, if you want to look at it. But it's just, it's amazing how you do see, amidst all this bullshit, you do see people coming out and helping and all that stuff. But we just have a lot of work to do, and people have been ignoring it for years. And, you know, it's just,
I think what's really hard, and sorry to interrupt, is just what you said earlier.
I'm a black man, and you interrupted me, Liz. This is a bad week to do that.
I don't see color.
And that's part of the problem, Liz.
You're just one of my annoying friends.
That's the gaslighting that I'm talking about. You see what happened, people? You see what happens when you try to have white people on the shows? Jesus Christ, man. Fuck.
But no, what you were saying about, go fuck yourself. What you were saying about, is that part of the movement? To be able to tell you to go fuck yourself? Okay, no.
Well, that's kind of.
I just want to be in a place where I can tell everybody to go fuck themselves. That's when you know everything is right. Mm-hmm. But no, what you were talking about with empathy is what I really struggle with, which is I personally cannot see anybody, whether you're a woman and all the issues we've had with being a woman in this country, if you are any person of color, whether you're an Asian person, an Indian person, a Latino, like anybody that isn't this fucking definition of white, if you are poor or financially struggling or barely, you know what I mean? If you're like financially a minority, you know what I mean? Like that's the kind of thing where I'm like, if you're anybody but a rich white person, how do you not?
Right.
How do you not have empathy for other people being marginalized or disrespected or ignored or killed or, you know, whatever is going on? Like, that's where it gets like, it's really hard to talk to somebody where you're like, what? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I know you've had your own shitty experiences. So how can you not take your shitty experience and at the very least, try to put yourself in their situation to a very similar, scary, shitty situation. Like, that's where I don't get it. Like, I can kind of see if you've never had anything all that awful happen or things just seem to work out for you, how you wouldn't know the privileges and the leg up and the benefits that you get for how your life has been set up in this country. But there's so many other people that, you know, when you hear about, black people voting for Trump, or you hear about immigrants voting for Trump, or anybody that isn't rich voting for Trump, you're just like,
I was listening to Dan Le Batard, who's a sports journalist and a radio broadcaster for ESPN. Really love this dude, really love his and appreciate his takes. He was talking about, like, to your point about, like, minorities voting for Trump and being Republican. It's sort of like this. This has come up, too, like, in the past couple of days, like a model minority where it's like there's people that could come from another country and look at American blacks as, like, beneath them. And if you do that, you can start your journey to the pursuit of whiteness, which means that you can have this, it's that privilege you seek, like whiteness as an idea, and an ideal of what it means to be prosperous in this country. I'm better than you because I've attained all this status and I can be just like my white counterparts, when really you're not. You're never going to be that. So you can try to deny who you are as much as you want. But when you get to that, even when you get to the high of highs, LeBron James, as great as he is as an athlete and all the great stuff he's done in the community, the people still wrote nigger on his garage door in front of one of his houses. So it's just like that thing is like, well, I'm not like the rest of them. You know, like those people that those people that are like on like those black people that are like on Fox News and they're getting all these YouTube followers, and because they're saying it's money in, like, people like Candace Owens, there's money in shitting on black people. You know, it's just it's a different.
How do they not have a drug problem? Like, how do they sleep at night? Like,
I don't know. I mean, maybe they sleep pretty well if they got like 5,000 count sheets. I don't know, but it's something.
we're like, I don't know what's in that Egyptian cotton. Maybe it really just does change.
I don't know. Like, I always joke with some of my friends about just like doing that heel turn, like in pro wrestling, and just going that way. But it's just you have to be able to live with yourself, and I think there's always gonna be like, I think you're always gonna have to come home, and you're always gonna, like, when OJ got in trouble, he can't try to come back to the black community. You know, it's just one of those things. It's like, it is like that whole I'm not black, I'm OJ. You know, like that's. It's an intimate relationship that black people have with this country, and it's just a really intimate relationship that I'm not going to be the person to say, you'll never fucking understand, Liz. And I'm not saying that to you. I am saying it to you, but it's like, you'll never fucking understand. But you can have like, you can have an idea. It's like, if you have any black girlfriends or they can understand how you live because of who, because they're on one level, it's like they can understand how you live because you're a human, and they can understand, like, culturally, they can understand that. But vice versa, you don't have to. Like, there's like survival, like, black people, we got to know how everybody operates, especially white people, in order to survive in this country. White people, you don't have to do that at all, unless you want to, unless you decide to take that, those steps, those leaps, those jumps. You know what I mean? And I'm not saying. Go ahead.
I 100% agree with you. Like, I will never know what it's like to live as a black person in this country. I mean, I have my silly joke in my special where I talk about looking ethnically ambiguous.
Yes, yeah.
And how I'm just like, what about all the opportunities I've lost because people don't know I'm white?
It's a great joke.
It's a very flippant, silly joke that, you know, poking fun at that aspect. But it kind of goes back to what I said before, though, which is, as a woman, you know, I read John Laster had a beautiful post about, you know, every time he was stopped by a cop having a gun to his head, all these horrible things that have happened to him in his life, and him walking home and crying and feeling, you know, invisible, scared, you know, all the range of emotions. And I read that and I was like, how is this not, you know, it is different from the Me Too movement, but this, a lot of this is very parallel to the Me Too movement in the sense that, you know, a lot of people didn't listen to anybody until they really saw how horrific Harvey Weinstein was. Even though it's been talked about on shows and in the zeitgeist, and it's always been kind of out that he was awful and that this stuff happens and da 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 da. And, you know, why, like, you want to pretend, like, why do they tell every woman, text me when you get home? Or, hey, make sure, you know, you shouldn't be out at night, or, you know, just, you know, so it's like one of those things where you're like, people know because there's all these little things where here's pepper spray and don't walk home late at night and here's money for an Uber and did you get home safe? All these little kind of like half-ass ideas of protection.
Right.
And the same. And then, of course, then it gets wet in the open. You're like, well, everybody's getting sexually assaulted and raped out there. And we're like, yeah, we've been saying that. Why haven't you been listening? And that's how it feels with the Black Lives Matter movement, which is you have to be in a closet with the door shut if you haven't heard every single person in your life, or whether they're absolutely in your life or they're just on TV or however, you know, your community is, say, we are scared. We are being killed. We are not looked at as equals. You know, to me, you truly have to be with your ears plugged going, na, 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 to have this being the first time you noticed that this was happening.
Right.
And so for me, when I hear a woman say, you know, I don't get it, you just want to be like, what do you mean you don't get it? Like, it's how is it? It's clearly different. I don't want to say it's the same, but that fear, that feeling disregarded, having going to the police and them doing nothing about it, or they go to court and they get a slap on the wrist, even though they ruined your life. Like, that, to me, that's so parallel. It's, and it's a different type of systemic ignorance or withdrawal of humanity. But I that's where, like, and I don't need that parallel. I can see humans as humans, but if you have to have empathy, if you have to have experience to have empathy, how is it not there for at least half the world?
Oh,
that's
yeah.
where I get so pissed off. Like, you've Michael Che was on Seth the other day talking about how he's never called 911. He's like, it just feels like that police weren't there to help me specifically. And I am deathly afraid of police at nighttime. So if I get pulled over by the cop, you know, before 6 p.m., it's light out, you know, somebody on the side of the road could see if something bad happened to me. But at nighttime, when less people are on the road, people don't really, you know, other people are scared. I am terrified of being stopped by a cop late at night on the highway where what happens to me is disregarded, because it has happened. You know what I mean? There have been women that are killed and raped by police yeah. officers. So to me, even just there, it's just like, yeah, there's certain times where my humanity is disregarded and I have deep fear of the police. And I just, you know, I'm happy there are people that are like, they're pillars of the community and they've never done anything but help me, you know, and that's, I'm happy for you, that rosy experience. But how are you going to pretend like everybody shouting, this isn't how everybody else lives, and just being like, well, I don't see it.
Yeah.
Like, that's, you don't, well, yeah, you don't see yeah. Jesus and you believe in him. Like, that's where it just gets crazy.
Yeah. I think that's part of the gaslighting, and I think it's there. It's there in the Me Too movement. It's there with Black Lives Matter and all that stuff. It's so interesting that you mentioned that. Like, I don't know why the fuck somebody, I think Jake Flores posted, like, he said, you know, if you want to, it might have been Jake or JL Coven that says something, you know, I'm watching the Epstein documentary on Netflix to take a break from everything that's yeah. going on. And I watched yeah, yeah. it because I watched it. And it's crazy how they just let him get away with that stuff for so many years, yeah. and they just let him get away. And then at the same time, I watched this HBO documentary called On the Record, which was about Russell Simmons, like the abuse that Russell Simmons had. Like, he was accused of abusing, sexually assaulting, raping a lot of women. And there's this one woman named Drew Dixon who was a music executive. She was one of the people behind, if you... I don't know what you were listening. I think I got 7 or 8 years on you. How old are you now?
I'm 34.
I have 6 years on you. So I know you remember Mary J. Blige and Method Man. You're All I Need. You
of
know,
course, they're the best.
She's the woman. She's one of the people behind that, and she like was really integral. Is it integral? Integral.
Integral.
She's very important in the hip hop community.
I'm like, I'm dyslexic. I was like, I'm not the one that
in the 90s. And she was great. She fucking stopped because she was sexually assaulted by Russell Simmons, and when she ended like her time with Russell Simmons, she went to L.A. Reid, and he would not help her out unless she slept with him. She didn't sleep with him. This yeah. woman brought Kanye West to L.A. Reid, and L.A. Reid wouldn't sign him because this woman, Drew Dixon, wouldn't sleep with him. Kanye West and John Legend. She wanted him to sign John Legend. This dude, L.A. Reid, wouldn't sign John Legend because he was just like, he was holding that over her. Like, she had to sleep with him. She had to play ball. And so she just ended her career.
Yeah.
And you have this woman that has all this talent and bringing these people into the industry, signing these people these super talented people, putting them together to do really great projects. And we've lost that. We lost her. The hip hop community lost this woman. You think about what happened like with Louis C.K. or all the people that got blocked, and people, these women that were trying to have a career and they just got shut down. I know everybody's favorite comedian, one of mine too, Dave Chappelle, said like that brittle spirit thing. So be it. That's a take. But you think about people in all these industries that are talented that get shut down because they just get, I didn't know this shit was going to be like this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Think about like a lot of your peers, you know, that that stopped for whatever reason. It's just, it's in a male dominated field.
I also want to be like, Hollywood and the music and all this stuff is already hard without abuse and sexual assault. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, part of you is like, hey, we don't need an extra barrier. Like, it's already, like, you talk to white guys and they're like, fucking comedy is really hard and it hurts my feelings. Like, I was like, and then imagine being scared.
Right,
You know what I mean? Like, then imagine being, like, I've had countless friends that while driving to gigs have been stopped by the police. Like, that's, you know what I mean? Like, they're just trying to go to work. Like, I have to add in extra time, you know, to get to gigs because of traffic. I can't imagine having to add extra time for traffic and then also while driving black. You know what I mean?
God,
like, so it's like, this, doing anything that is saturated and hard and what have you and blah, blah, blah is already hard enough. You don't need any barriers. And I love Chappelle. I think he's incredible. One of the things that I actually quote all the time that I do like is that he talks about you have to accept imperfect allies. Mm-hmm. I think that, I mean, I've used that even when I've talked to people. I was like, I'm going to make mistakes. And you also have to leave some room for me to learn. And you also have to believe that even if we're not 100% on the same page, doesn't mean that we're still not on the same page. You know
that's
what I
true.
Mean? Like,
it's
just, that's what I do appreciate about Chappelle. And there's tons of things I've seen by Bill Burr, by Chappelle, you know, a range of comics that I love and appreciate. And I, you know, always want to be fans of, but at the same time, I can look at a joke that I don't like by Bill Burr and be like, I still, even if it's not for me, I still see what he's doing. And there's tons of jokes that I love.
Oh yeah,
by
that's
him.
Everybody. That's just like, I didn't like that. You can, it's like, and a lot of times the shit, it's jokes, and yeah, there may be truth behind it, and you know, a lot of comedians get the famous ones, they get mainly the black ones, they get called on, you know, what they say is like that shit is Sanskrit, like it's like, but really it's just, it's a joke. And you know, you hear the thing where people say, oh, the comedians get more scrutiny than politicians do, and it seems like they do. We do sometimes. I just brought it up. It made me think about that, like the brittle spirit. I get where he's coming from. Like, you know, there, I understand that. But it's just like, I don't know.
It's like I heard it and I was like, I agree and don't agree.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like,
I
was like, there's definitely comics that were like, I don't know if you're strong enough to do this, but I'm not like, you need to be raped so we know you're ready.
like, you got to get a little dirt on you. Yeah.
Yeah. Like everything's hard. I mean, I'm sure people who are trying to get to NASA, it's fucking hard, but nobody needs their rights to be violated. And that's, and that's literally what the black community is saying right now. Like, hey, we just want to be treated like everybody else. Like, life is hard enough. Like, why are you making it not only impossible to move forward, but why are you making it impossible to live? And it's like, I find it so crazy when I have people push back from even the stuff that I've posted, or even jokes that
were they mostly white, Liz?
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, but you know, there are some people of color that they don't like the language that was picked. Like, I had a guy, I reposted, somebody wrote something. Crap, let me see if I can find it, because I understand things might not be phrased perfectly, but a friend posted this and I, like, reshared it. Mm-hmm. But he wrote,
We don't need hugs and high fives from police. We need systematic change and accountability. Anything less is just a PR stunt. Don't lose focus. Black Lives Matter. And so I shared it, and then I had somebody that was a person of color come back and be like, yeah, my Instagram just started talking to me. Somebody wrote back and was just like, he pushed back on it. And I go, I don't really understand what you mean. And he goes, so we just don't accept anything? And I go, that's not what I'm saying.
You don't have to fucking comment to that. Fuck that. That's just somebody that wants to argue. That's the shit
I will say this. The guy, I said what I was about to say to you, and he did listen a little bit. I don't know if I changed him, but he basically said, I basically said to him, I go, what they're saying is that the PR stuff, the hugs and the kneeling, that's nice. And that's, you know, 0.5% progress. I mean, that would have been nice Kaepernick years ago. You know what I mean? It's a little too late for just kneeling now, guys. But what I'm saying is, like, if every sex offender is on a list and it never gets erased and anybody can find it, why, if you're not going to get rid of bad cops, why isn't that same accountability there? Yeah. You know what I mean? Why isn't it that if you have something on your record that says that you've done X, Y, and Z, if you're not going to fire them, at the very least, we as a people should know that this person is problematic. The same way if I move into a neighborhood and know that my neighbor is a pedophile.
Right.
Then even more so, you know, if somebody blatantly murders somebody that is 100% not a threat, like George Floyd, that is murder. That's murder. Why are police not charged for murder? Like, not fuck having them fired. They murdered somebody.
Yeah.
We put drug dealers, non-violent drug dealers, behind bars for half their life. And you're not going to put a murderer behind bars? You're just kind of like, this is insanity. And that's where I was just like, come on, man. And he was like, I see that. And I think he misinterpreted what I said, which is like, I'm saying it's, you know, he is like, well, you're just, nothing's good enough. And I was like, I'm not saying it's not nice, but we're not looking for nice. We're looking for change. We're looking for accountability. We're looking for, yes, we can't fix racism in a march, but we can fix laws in voting and change.
Right, right.
And that's all it is.
Yeah, I don't even argue with people. I don't even argue with people on the internet about movies or video games. I just say, I like the shit, and I'll tweet about what I like. Well, I was like, well, that's you. You didn't. So
yeah.
I'm just like, I'm just like, fuck.
I was talking to a lot. Yeah.
Go ahead. Say it. Say what you say. It.
No, because I was talking to Alonzo Bowden, because Alonzo saw me arguing with people, and he goes, he's like, oh man, he's like, bless you. He's like, I don't have it in me.
Yeah.
And of course I had like 9 arguments, and then I texted him and I was like, dude, people are fucking insane. And he goes, you got to let it go, Liz. He's like, you can't let trolls. But this is the problem. If a troll says something shitty about me personally, or something shitty about my comedy, or something shitty about women, me not responding to it isn't a go ahead. It cannot be interpreted as yes, of course I'm a piece of shit.
Do you tell him to fuck off?
No, I say nothing, because it's not a good use of my time. There's nothing, they already don't like women or don't like me. So nothing I'm going to say is going to change them. So I leave it up for 2 reasons. I leave it up for people to know that I am not beloved, that this is hard, and that that being a public figure, being vulnerable and being an artist is real work, and it's hurtful.
Yeah.
And there's a vulnerability in it. And then I also leave it up because people will come up to me and be like, no, there's no way that people say women aren't funny. Dude, I get it every day, all day long. Every day, all day long. I get harassed every day, all day long. So there's no way that you can say that there's not sexism in this industry or in this world when it's every day, all day long, because I posted a cat video. So that, you know what I mean? So when it's directed at me or women, there's no way for someone to interpret it that I'm accepting this as okay, as opposed to I post something that says Black Lives Matter and somebody goes, all lives matter, or they go, you know, this isn't really happening, or whatever fucking conspiracy bullshit they post. If I do not respond and keep it up, it looks like I'm accepting that, or I'm okay with that. And when I, as somebody that is not black, and as somebody that isn't dealing with the consequences of what's going on right now the same way. I cannot leave that up without, at the very least, doing my best to stick up for what I believe in, but also stick up for the people in my life and in the world. And if it doesn't get through to them, it doesn't get through to them. And I also, you know, I'm not, you know, I wish I was as famous as Seth Rogen and could just tell everybody to fuck off. But the way I actually handle any hate comments directed towards me and towards others is I'm going to talk to them the way my therapist talks to me. And I'm going to talk to them with an assumption that they are a person that is good at heart and that they are just projecting their pain onto this specific topic.
That's true,
and
too.
I could be wrong. There are assholes out there. But I will tell you this, even when 99% of the people that were angry at me for the math joke that I posted, even when we didn't come to an agreement, said thank you for saying things the way you did. I don't agree with you. I don't think I can be a fan anymore, but I appreciate how you talk to me. And I even had somebody that was like harassing one of the girls that was upset with me. And I said, hey, she's allowed to feel how she feels. Do not belittle her. You can say you don't agree. You can say that this is a joke you enjoy, but you cannot belittle her experiences. And I feel the same way about the people posting. I'm not going to belittle your experience if that's how you feel, but you have to at least listen to me if I validate you. Does that make sense?
Oh, sure.
And that even is a position of power for me because they're attacking my friends and family. They're not attacking me. So I'm in a position of power in that sense, which is I have more followers than them. I have a fan base. And I'm not directly being talked about in this situation. Now, can I do it for everything? There's tons of people that I was just like, you already set in stone how you feel, and there's nothing I can say that can change your mind. And I don't have time for people that don't want to see people as people. I literally said, I wrote, I care about people, and you wrote back, you shouldn't care about people. So where are we supposed to go from here? So I have like ended the conversation with, hey, you just want to argue and I have things to do and I'm more important than you.
I mean, sometimes you got to hit them and knock them down. And then on their way down, you just kind of lay them down with one hand and let them fall to the floor gently. And then
I agree.
You know, well, it's one of those things, and I think that some you handle it the way that you feel comfortable handling it. But I think you're the type of person I never really thought of you. I'm on a group text with some black men, some black comedians, and they sent a screenshot of something this morning about a booker that was saying some racist shit. And I was like, oh, somebody called this person out. I was like, oh, shit. I didn't know she was like that. And I didn't know that. I thought this person was a person of color. Like, you know, she wasn't black. You know, she was like, that's like that model minority thing I was telling you about that called this person an N-word. And I was like, oh, shit.
Wow.
So and threatened to call the cops on me. I was like, I would have never thought. I was like, damn. So it's just, I think you might have a bit about it. Like, what is it like upgrading your? It's like a phone up. A lot of comics kind of have a variation on the same theme. Like, it's like a phone. You update that shit. You update. Update the software.
Basically, if your morals and I forget how I even phrased it. It's such an old joke. Are set in the 50s. Maybe your technology should stay there too.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you don't think gay people should get married, then you can't use the internet. Like, it's like, it's like that kind of thing. But I've always felt that way, which is, you know, you're allowed to have grew up in a different time or have made mistakes or have been, seen things differently. But if you can never open your heart to new information as a human, then why are you so easy to update your phone or update the internet or learn TikTok? You know, like if you can learn TikTok, you can learn loving other people. Like, come on, man. Like, it's just that to me, and you know what's so crazy about it?
What
like
is
I've
it
talked nice? About it with my friends. I wasn't raised in a, I was raised in a pretty white
and I was like, I grew up in Jersey, so it's honestly, it's white people and Indian people.
It's like near, near Princeton, right?
Yeah, I was in Princeton when I was really young, which was a little bit more diverse, actually, like West Windsor area. And then I moved about 20 minutes away, and it was a lot whiter. And I mean, I grew up.
What is that? Is that like Route 1?
Yeah, Route 1.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm trying to think the last. It was a nice ride. Yeah. I was trying to remember. I've been to Princeton Record Exchange.
One of the best. One of the best records.
I need to go back because I need to get rid of some CDs. Jesus Christ. But I did a gig. I think I did a gig in Newtown, Pennsylvania, and I went back that way. And like they had like all the shopping centers and shit. But anyway, so that's pretty. It is just like white people and Indians, right?
Yeah. So I would say my experience with black people specifically was probably gymnastics. So my teammates and my coaches. And think of it this way: I grew up pretty sad and in a difficult childhood. And, you know, gymnastics is grueling and hard, but I loved it, and flipping is fun and whatnot. And the positive influence I had was probably one of the biggest influences was I had a black coach. I cannot remember his name. I was like 7, but he was the kindest person. And in my mind, he was the coolest person because he had snakes that he would bring in and like baby alligators. Like he would have like the mouth, like it would be rubber band, and he would bring it in after class, like in the summer and stuff. And we get to play with these like reptiles. And he was a good coach. He was encouraging. He was kind. And for 3 hours, 4 days a week, somebody made me feel like I was doing good and I was important. And I don't know if this is true, but as somebody, and my parents are good people, but my parents never were like, all people are people and we treat everybody the same. Like I saw it, like my parents were kind to everybody, but my parents don't talk about their feelings now. I can't imagine they talked about them then.
They just sort of live by example, treat people nice. And
My parents have never treated anybody in any aspect, whether you bagged groceries or you were fucking the best client at their vet clinic.
Sure.
So I think in some sense, just who they were as people is an influence. But I think having my other gymnastic teammates be people of color, and then also my coaches, I think that was an influence of, here's somebody that's an authority. Keep that in mind. That's also an authority figure I did gymnastics until I was 14 years old.
Did we talk about this before? The first time you were on? I feel like maybe we did.
That I did gymnastics?
It's like 7 or 8 years ago when you were, I don't remember.
Oh, also my heroes when I was a kid. So Dominique.
God, I had the biggest crush on her. I'll tell you about.
Dude, I had a gymnastics crush on her. I was like, I want to be Dominique Dawes. People always told me I looked like Dominique Muciano. But like Dominique Dawes was a powerhouse. Like I just was a tiny white girl. But like Dominique Dawes, and now with Simone Biles, I never know how to say her name.
That's her name. Like, that's right.
Dude, holy shit. Like every time a video of hers pops up, I stop what I'm doing and I'm watching it. I'm like, she is a goddamn hero. So that's also interesting too. And like, of course I got into hip hop and R&B and blah, blah, blah. But like, it's, you know what I mean? Like, it's just good music and I love it. But if you think of it on a basic level, the people I hung out with them more than I hung out with classmates in a lot of ways. Cause a class, you're just listening to a teacher and you're at your desk, you get recess and lunch. And I didn't really have a lot of friends, but my teammates, my coaches, I spent more time with them than anybody else.
Yeah.
So you also think of that aspect and the influence people have on you as a child. My parents were good people, and the people in my life that were people of color had a huge influence on me. But again, I can't tell you if that's how things work or not, but it is fascinating to me that I never had to be taught this shit. And then I go into a work environment where, you know, like I said, this woman that was like teaching me about Jews, I'm like, I'm more Jewish than I am Catholic. Like, you know what I mean? Like between the people I've dated and my community, I know way more about the black community and Judaism than I know about being Catholic. I've never even been inside a church. So it's fascinating for me to watch people even make an excuse of like, well, I didn't grow up around different people. Well,
yeah,
it's not that hard to go around and associate with different people. Like,
it's really not
a documentary.
And it's fucking boring. If you don't like, one of the best like working experiences I ever had was when I was in grad school and I worked at Best Buy, in Chicago. And it was like, I loved it 'cause you know, I can get gadgets and music and movies and shit. But the other thing, it was like, it was fun because there were different types of people. There were white, black, Asian, Latino, all different types of people in that place. And it just made it, it made things interesting. And then like, that was, I mean, like, 'cause growing up in the DC area, like the, in Prince George's County, like it's predominantly black and there's just like white people. There's some, a little bit of everybody, but I didn't really immerse myself into a real city setting until I moved to Chicago when I was 22. And then I did learn, I mean, I knew about Jewish people, but I was around them more, and all that stuff, and just Indian people. And just like, it wasn't a big deal. It was like, oh, you guys, yeah, you guys do this thing different, or this is, these are kebabs. Okay. This is, this is shawarma. All right. Okay. You know, let's go to work.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So I think if you're a minority in this country, or you're somebody who is not necessarily high on the totem pole, most people, I'm just going to make a blanket statement. In general, it's I think sometimes more accepting, or it's easier to, I think it's maybe a survival technique or a survival mechanism, more than anything, now that I think about it. In order to survive, I got to learn how this system operates and how it affects me and how I can get what I need out of it. Not necessarily as a selfish thing, but just how I can operate, how I can fit in, how I could evolve and all those things. Yeah, it's just we just got to keep working on ourselves. And I think that's what it's about to be an artist. Like you're trying to grow. You're trying to be a better person. And in that pursuit, you fail. And then you can talk about that shit on stage, which is what I appreciate what you do. So let's close by talking about your special, Self-Help Me. I think it's your best work. And I hate to say that, but
I'd rather be my most recent, be my best work. You peaked 4 years ago.
I hate to compliment you because you're a woman.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I understand. Yeah. Yeah.
But, and you're Liz. So it's it's what I appreciate. I feel like you've always kind of been grounded in what you're saying, but like you, I feel like you've kind of evolved a little bit in the way that you're, it seems like you're having a little more fun on stage. You're a little more animated than you normally, than you used to be. Like even, I just noticed, like I was just watching the special. And I think like there's one point, but like that you, the camping joke, like where you're more animated, but then you get to the bit. Oh shit. It's like 10 minutes in. I'm trying to remember what that bit is. But you like when you get on the punch, I should pull up my iTunes to look at the track list. But when you sometimes your punchlines, you're yelling, or you're yelling the tag, or like it's like you're just like more tied to the material where you're just like fucking in it. And it's like you're just like locked in more instead of what do you think?
I agree. I think it took me I was very monotone when I started, and yes. I was very fearful of moving my body and being animated. I think I was just insecure as a person, insecure as a woman, insecure as a performer. And it took me, I think, a lot longer than most people I was insecure even in my own life, like expressing my anger, even understanding my anger. So I think with both becoming more confident in my private life, being more myself around, you know, the people I love, and that love me. And then, building a fan base, being more accepted in the comedy community, getting more opportunities. And then just, like I said, being more, myself at home, it allowed me to be more myself on stage. Ranty Liz, everybody knows Ranty Liz in my life exists. So for people to see Ranty Angry Liz on stage is for them to my words started to match how I express myself off stage. And so I think it took me a lot longer than most people. I think my words and my confidence, as a comic were always there, but I think the performance aspect and the delivery aspect took a lot longer because I, as a person, was really insecure and really scared to be myself. So, I do think this is my best work. I do. I like the jokes. I like the topics. I like how I deliver it. I'm really proud of it. There's definitely, you know, there's always things you wish you did better and blah, blah, blah. But as its final piece, and also to do a special for the first time, because my other two are albums. I released the video of my first hour, but like people call it a special, but I was like, it was truly an album recording, and someone had a camera, like, you know, I hired a guy with a camera. But this was, you know, a 5-camera shoot. And I mean, this cost me my savings right before I really needed it.
I want to get to that too. But like, I just had to, yeah, I think my favorite joke is the sandwich.
Pretty Privilege?
Pretty Privilege is my favorite. But I was trying to think of the rant. It was like 10 minutes into the set. And I was like, yeah, that's it. Because it's like it kind of started like, I was like, oh, I like that energy that you put in it where like, I don't want to burn the camp. I don't want to burn. Everybody watch the special and buy it when it comes out on audio. But like you kind of, like the rant. Fuck. I wish that I knew what bit it was. But I really like that. The Pretty Privilege is my favorite joke. Cause like, it's like, you're like, I'm pretty enough to get a sandwich for free, but not to have like my rent paid for. Hot? What is it?
So yeah.
Do your joke now.
Shut up. I'm going to butcher my own joke. It's like, I'm get a free sandwich cute, but I'm not had my rent paid hot.
Yeah.
Something like that. You gotta watch it, guys. I don't know my jokes.
Yeah.
Anymore.
Watch the special.
I'm not a comedian. Yeah. I mean, if anything, I would say I've been friends with Hari Kondabolu for God, 10 years. And I've been opening for him pretty consistently for about 3. And that's, I mean, to me, being even slightly talking about politics or even having certain buzzwords would be an influence from Hari. And then even just the encouragement to keep writing about it is 100% Hari. Like, I might tell him an idea I have and he goes, yes, write that.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I'm just saying, rather than I might not have pursued it as much because I've always been more personal. And even that Pretty Privilege is a personal joke, but it's in the framework of white privilege and what that means, and pretty privilege and what that means.
Yeah. I really like it. I think like, cause a lot of your stuff is really, it's really smart. Like, I like that you're very, like, you could see the structure in, and it's like, it's very well thought out. And I feel like once you've said it and once you seem like you're happy enough to present it in a special, that you've thought about it, you know, like you've thought about these bits and how and the structure, but then like the performance was just like enhanced because it just felt like, yeah, you're actually performing this material, you know. It's like you, because like you said, you were like kind of monotone in the beginning where like you like set up punch. I know this is funny and I know it's funny, but this one, it just seemed like you were just way more. It's just like grounded. It was just like all around, like just, it seems like you're having more fun on stage. Like, I even looked at like a little bit of like emotionally available. What is it? Emotionally exhausting. And like you smiled. I was like, oh yeah. See that. And that was what? 3 years ago, maybe?
Five years ago.
That was 5 years ago.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
What was the first one?
Emotionally exhausting. So emotionally exhausting.
The second one.
5 years.
Mind over melee was
Mind Over Melee was, I think, 3 years ago.
Oh, fuck. Okay. And, yeah. All right.
Yeah. And I usually start, it takes me about a year and a half to write the hour. Mm-hmm. And then maybe I take a little more time, a couple more months to kind of polish it or start figuring out when I'm going to, the next move I'm going to make. But it's usually about 2.5 years for me to put something out. And this, I was supposed to hopefully put something out like the fall, I was hoping, of 2019, and then things didn't work out and I had to figure it out on my own. So I took another year to like organize it. So like I actually wrote probably an hour and a half of material, and I cut a good 25 minutes from what could have been my hour to make this hour. So I think this one was also stronger because I overwrote, not intentionally. I just, mm-hmm. I thought other opportunities were going to come about. And then they didn't. And then I had more time to write, and I'm just a writer. So I think the fact that I overwrote and I could cut certain bits that were weaker made this even stronger as well.
So did you do an hour and a half at these tapings?
No, I just, I,
you
I
just
wrote
cut it
an
before.
Hour and a half. Yeah. So like I said, it takes me about a year and a half to write an hour. Mm-hmm. And this took me about 2.5 years to start producing something. So I wrote more material. Then I just cut it down to an hour.
So when you were ready to do this, like when did you say, okay, this is self-help me, and this is the hour, this is the special? Did you shop it around, or what did you do? Like prior to saying, tell me what happened for you to say, I'm investing in myself, I'm putting my savings towards this. What happened before that? Like you had everything ready, took you like the year and a half, 2 years, you're ready to do this thing. Talk about that process and what led you to say, well, fuck it, I'll do it myself.
I auditioned for HBO. Like I had 4 executives come out and see the hour. And I actually, because it was gonna be my first real big hour, I kind of, even though my hour was done for HBO, I took my best jokes from Emotionally Exhausting, my best jokes from Mind Over Melee, and then my best jokes from what in my mind was my third hour, Self Help Me. And I had been touring Australia and Europe and around the country with that specific mm-hmm. hour. So I kind of brought some old jokes back, morphed it together, and I did this one-off show at New York Comedy Club where 4 HBO executives came out, and they really liked it. And I had taped it. They sent it up higher up and more people talked about it. And it took about 4 months of, we like it, we need to show it to this person. We like it, now we have to show it to this person. We like it, now we have to show it to this person. And all my other friends were getting nose. And I was like, oh, this might happen. And how crazy is that? And, you know, I always knew it. And then I got a no, while I was on tour for like a month and a half by myself. And I was like, you know, the time to have heard a no was when I was around friends and family, mm-hmm. not when I'm going to be by myself. But I had a no. I was pretty devastated. But my thought was, I'm proud of this hour. I've made my own album. I could make it into another album again. I know how to do it. I have the money for it. But in my mind, I know enough. I've grown a lot from social media. And this is before I even started really having a following. I just kind of knew that what I was doing with social media was correct, and it was just going to keep building. And videos on YouTube and Instagram are the way to get your word out if you don't have management or an agent or what have you. I did have those at the time. I do not have them now. But I just knew video was the way to go. And then the way I work is, if I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it as professional as possible. That I don't just want to kind of cut corners and just have and call it a special when it doesn't look right. And I also see the influence of something looking TV ready, getting more attention online than something that was shot with an iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
So I started asking anybody that has made specials themselves, and or has done it where they made it and then they sold it, just to find out what I needed, how much it was going to cost, how long it would take, blah, 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 blah. So I started kind of doing like a budget sheet and a what I need sheet. And I approached my roommate, the fashion photographer and videographer. And so I kind of approached him and I was like, is this something you would be able to help me with? He said, yeah. He was able to kind of put together a little bit of a crew for me and outline it. We did a lot of research. So I never even hired a production company. I kind of made my roommate into a production company, or us into a production company.
That's great.
And then I started, you know, I kind of was like, I think I have the money. Cause I, from self-releasing both my albums, I get royalties every year. It's actually what's keeping me afloat financially right now, as I don't make money. So I never touched my royalties, and just because I knew in general, we have rainy days. I never thought this rainy day would happen,
yeah.
But we in general will just have bad months for no reason.
Sure.
And I've always, and December and July are always notoriously bad for me. So I just never touched my royalty money because I'm always expecting something bad to happen. I had no idea that I needed to prepare like this, but I was like, I have the money. I'm investing in myself. I know for a fact. And this, again, I was planning this before my videos really started to pop off online.
And but what are we talking? Is this 2019?
Yeah, I start. So I got rejected from HBO. I want to say February, either. Yeah, I think early February 2019.
Okay.
And so, you know, cry about it, feel frustrated.
Sure.
And then within 2 weeks being like, I want to do it myself, and then just feeling not ready. And then I feel like April was when I really started to be like, all right, I got to start figuring out venues. I got to start doing this. So I started like budgeting and figuring stuff out in April. And then I kind of knew by June I needed to pick a venue. Like, you need a couple of months to like pick a venue and get the cameras right and like all that stuff. So June is when I started to like go pick my venue, figure things out, start putting out down payment. I mean, I really planned a wedding. I've been calling it I paid the exact same money my sister did when she made her own wedding. I paid a small amount. It was like a small wedding. I had more people at my wedding, but,
shots fired at your sister. Jesus.
I know. Right. You know, less people were fed. They drank a lot.
Subculture, right?
Subculture. Yeah. That's where
I love that place.
I shot it. It's awesome. They were awesome. It was really expensive. And if I shot it at a comedy club or somewhere else, I probably could have saved myself a shit ton of money.
Oh, really? We have to talk about that off mic then. Cause I inadvertently recorded my EP from there because I just recorded,
oh, really?
But I recorded it on my phone. I was doing, yeah. I was doing, what the hell is the name of that show? If You Build It. I just had a good set and people were there to see Alana Glazer. So okay. I just followed her and destroyed. And so,
nice.
Yeah, and then just put it together. Andy Klein helped me sweeten up the sound and stuff. So
Andy's the best.
Yeah, but I love that place. It's something about that place. It's like you go in. It's in a what? Can you tell me what neighborhood that's in? What neighborhood is that?
I didn't even know that when I was saying it because it's like it's right by Bowery.
Yeah,
so it's not the East Village, but it's not the West Village, but it's
right.
But it's above Houston, so it's not Soho. To me, it's such a weird. It's, you know, it's right by the 6 train.
Yeah.
But like, it's not in my mind. It's not East or West, but it's also not Soho. So I fucking have no idea.
See, I'm so glad
I
that
I called it the West Village, but even I was insecure saying that. I was like, someone's gonna yell at me.
I'm so glad that you said that because Will Miles was on the show this week, and I was trying to tell him. Or some, it might have been Will, it might have been somebody else, or it was just me trying to explain where the fuck that place is, that I was just like, where is it? It's so cool. I don't know what neighborhood that's in. It's so weird.
Yeah.
It's so weird.
Every time I told people about my show, my taping, mm-hmm. I changed the location because I could never find confidence of what that area is called. I was like, you know, Lower East Side. Soho,
yeah.
West Village. Like every time, I was like, I'm making shit up right now.
It's so weird because you don't need. And then we'll get back to your special. But it's like that place is so weird because it's like when I go home, more often than not, I like to go the West Side Highway and to go home, but to go back to Jersey to the GWB. And it's like, where am I? Which way do I go? Even if I have GPS on, it's just like. This seems so weird. It's like a weird ass part of anyway. Okay, but you've confirmed and made me feel better for my thoughts about that place.
You're welcome.
So continue about your journey. Sorry.
But yeah, so anyway, I fucking spent a small wedding amount of money, put this thing together. Then my boyfriend's best friend is an editor. He was he edited for This Week at the Comedy Cellar and a bunch of other Comedy Central stuff and documentaries. Oh, cool. And blah, blah, blah. So it was really nice having, and he's, become a friend of mine. So it was really nice having a friend be able to like have him. He knows my comedy from doing This Week at the Comedy Cellar, but then to have him do a one over, sit down with him, when I was insecure about certain things, cause, like there's, some of the edits, like, again, like I look at somebody at like Mark Norman's, and like Mark has an agent and a manager and like people that help him make decisions. Nobody helped me make a decision. I just decided I don't want a camera on the audience. And then of course I'm sitting down with my editor and he's like, it would have really been nice if you had a camera on the audience. I was like, well, I don't want audience shots. He goes, yeah, but you messed up this word in both tapings and I can edit it together sound wise and fix it, but it won't look good visually. So if we shot to the audience, the edit, it wouldn't have, your sound would have been exactly what you wanted to sound like, but your video doesn't line up. So we would have had a shot of the audience, and that's what they do. They cover up mistakes with audience. And I go, well, nobody told me that.
Well, you learn, but I mean, and nobody fucking noticed. Nobody notices that shit, but you and the technical staff. I understand. I totally understand where you're coming from, because when you put something out, but then the next time you do it, you'll know. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, exactly what you're saying. I it's all a learning experience, and for me, as somebody that's been the person that encourages people to put albums out on their own, or even now encouraging people to do specials if they can, like I've learned, so much. I've learned so much, both positive and negative, that I did for the special. And I'm still proud of it. Like there's definitely things that I'm unhappy about with it, but I'm still all around proud of it. I mean, I released it in the middle of a protest and riots. I can't, yeah. I had a girl being like, is this the time? And I go, I don't know what to tell you. Like, this is, I don't
look,
you
man.
Know what I mean? Like,
yeah, you can't,
I'm not negating what's happening. To the fact that tons of people were like, thank you so much, this was a much needed, but
right.
Nobody wants to watch news 24/7. So it's like one of those things where like, again, it never feels like you can do anything right. But like, I didn't plan to release it during I did during a pandemic because it was like
selfish white woman.
Every time.
Who booked you on this show? Who booked you on my show? Jesus.
I know. This is just I think this is a way to be like, told you Liz, you're wrong. You're wrong, and you've always been wrong.
No, you know what?
Favorite thing to say to me.
You can't. That's not true. There's like. I put my EP out because I like all the people that I really know and respect in the game that have been doing it longer than me, like yourself, you put shit out. If something would have happened to you, and we have Liz Mealy's albums, we have This Is What She Left Behind. If that happened to me, if I died without putting something out, I would have felt like a failure. Cause me putting my EP out was a reaction to the pandemic, it was, and it was sort of like I wanted to have it like a wedding. I'm going to do it at this place and I'm going to wear these sneakers and this person is opening, this person is hosting. And when you think about like all this other life stuff happens, and then it doesn't happen. Then the pandemic, then you get shut down. And then it's like, well, what the fuck? You do start to think about what have I done? What the thing that I've dedicated a lot of my life to, show business, is like not there anymore. And what do I have to show for it? So I was like, well, I wanted to put something together. It's 24 minutes. This is who I was at the time. And this is part of me, and I wanted to put something out because I wanted to put something out with a barcode on it. That's been always been one of my dreams from putting that out. And I put it out. It did, the algorithms worked in my favor, and it was the number one album, comedy album on iTunes for most of the day, and it was in the top 20 and all that shit. And I woke up getting a text from Andy and Randolph and seeing that screenshot. I broke down and cried. Like, my listeners know, like, I was just like fucking bawling because I was just like, wow, that's people in a pandemic spent $8 and probably like $9.63 with the tax, and they bought something that I put out. And that was a humbling thing, because you think all your life you're trying to do, you're doing all the sacrifice that you make, all those things that you do, you're helping somebody. I don't know. I feel like this is everybody's turning to the arts. Everybody's turning to, like, there was an episode of Insecure that came out on Sunday that was like a beautiful episode that people said, wow, we needed this. Like, we did, like, as the black community needed this, you know? I mean, white people can watch the show too, obviously, but I'm just saying, like, so you helped people putting your shit out there. You know what I mean? I was in the chat for a little bit, you know, and I saw people were happy. Yeah. You know what I mean? So you can't worry about, people like that, man. It's never going to be the right time for everybody. Yeah. You know, fuck them.
Yeah.
Then don't watch. Watch something else. Watch the Epstein documentary.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. But I really wanted to highlight that because it's something, you're a woman and you did it yourself. And I think it's important. Like, people should know that. Like, that, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I do this podcast. You know?
Yeah, I think and yeah, I've been telling people whenever they're like, how can I support? I'm like, I knew what I was doing when I put it out during a pandemic. I knew I wasn't going to make my money back. And if I did, it was going to take a long time. And I get that. You know, the goal was clearly to sell it and make a lot of money. And that didn't happen. I got pretty close to selling it to Comedy Central like 2 weeks before they fired everybody.
Wow.
Like, I was talking to them for months. I actually would have, if Comedy Central had said no earlier, I would have put it out earlier. But I got delayed putting it out because I was pretty close and they were very nice to me. And then literally they were like, we're not buying anything. We have no budget. We can't, there's a spending hold. And then they fired everybody.
Damn.
So, you know, that delayed me even putting it out. Like, I would have probably put it out in March.
Hmm.
You know, for me, I just tell people the best way to support me is to like it, to comment, and to send it to a friend or two, because financially I'll make money back with sales and getting played on SiriusXM. And, you know, some people donated during the premiere and some people have sent Venmos, and that's all very nice. And I'm grateful.
Too.
I appreciated it.
I'm just being a dick.
You're a hero. You're a hero.
Applaud me. Make it about me.
You're a hero.
And go ahead.
I was going to say, but I don't think people understand. And it's even weirder because I know the value of new fans and, mm-hmm. and diehard fans, which is that they come to see you live. So even me saying, send it to a friend and subscribe, I'm still not going to make any money probably for like a year, because until stand-up becomes a thing that people go to and they're comfortable with, I literally make 90% of my income with live shows.
Mm-hmm.
So when you send a video to somebody and you follow me on Instagram or you follow me on YouTube, that has almost no value to me. What values to me is when I say, hey, I'm going to be in Toronto. Hey, I'm going to be in Detroit. Hey, I'm going to be in San Francisco. And you come and you bring your boyfriend or you bring your girlfriend or whatever. That's when I actually make my money and I'm able to survive as a comic. So my whole thing is I've completely delayed financial gratification and abundance and literally my ability to live with the hope that people like it, people share it, people follow me. And then when I come to your city, you come out and spend $20 to come see me.
Yeah. And then when is it going to be released in audio format?
It already is.
Oh, it already is. Okay. And they can get it wherever they buy music.
If you want to listen to it on Spotify, if you want to buy it on iTunes. I don't know if it's on Amazon yet. Everything, that's the other thing, is like even putting stuff out right now, it's really delayed. So usually it takes 5 days. And it,
I found out it was going to take 3 weeks, and I emailed them and it was like, hey, you got to put that on the website. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I did not factor that in. And I know tons of people that don't factor that in. And I was like, I'm not pretending like the pandemic's not coming about, but like, you got to update your website. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So
what did you do with CD Baby?
Yeah. Yeah. I like them a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. That's who I used too. And they were like, yeah, we're kind of backloaded and all that.
Yeah. And I think they're great. And I'm not delusional about why. I think more people are putting stuff out as any form of income, as well as, you know, people are working from home and they probably had to have their own layoffs. And I get that. I'm never delusional about what's happening, but like,
sure,
you know, put something on your landing page. Like,
yeah.
<you know>?
Yeah. Right.
I bought something from CVS like 2 weeks ago and it didn't work. It was like literally broken. And so I went to go return it. She goes, we don't do returns. And I go, what do you mean you don't do returns? She goes, yeah, since the pandemic, anything that leaves the store, we can't do returns. And I was like, dude, you got to have a sign or something. Like, it's been your policy since the beginning of time and now not. I was like, come on. And I was like, I'm not trying to be a dick. Like, I get it. But at the same time, I wouldn't have even made, like, this was $14. Like, and it's broken. It was never worked. And she goes, if you save your receipt when the pandemic's over, maybe we'll take it. And I was like, cool. Like, wow. But it was like a little bit like, have a sign, CVS. Like,
yeah.
What are we doing here?
Giving me a shitty product that doesn't work.
Yeah, I just wouldn't have taken the risk on something $14 I clearly didn't need.
Yeah, I would ask you what it is, but I'm kind of afraid that it's like a...
It's to trim your eyebrows.
Oh, I thought it was going to be like a feminine product or something.
A shitty what?
I thought it was going to be like a feminine product.
It is like... it's a thing, because like I get my eyebrows threaded or waxed, and I'm not a, like, let's open up so I can get a haircut because I don't care. But there is a 10% of me that's like, man, can we just open up for a day so I can get my eyebrows did? It's the only thing I care about. I've literally had dreams where I've gotten my eyebrows done in my dream and I woke up and I was sad. you know, I don't want to, you know, clearly put anybody at danger just because I have clearly one eyebrow. Like,
yeah.
That's really what's happening is I'm making one eyebrow right now. So I was trying to find a solution to do it on my own. And the thing didn't even work. Put two different batteries in it. Never worked. And I'm like, this is some bullshit.
Yeah, they got to give $14. They got to give you your money back.
Bullshit, CVS. I'm calling. I'm going to Karen you. I'm going to Karen you right now. I want to talk to your CVS CEO.
Manager. Look at the end of that long ass receipt and find that number. Yeah. I got my Karen on when I tried to order my parents' Red Lobster for delivery on Mother's Day, and they fucked it up. They never sent the food, so I just got I got it canceled. I canceled the cart, like I canceled the charge on from the bank, and then I just ordered them some crab legs from Gold Belly, like the service that like can get you fucking king crab legs from Seattle. So I got that sent to them. Yeah, it was way more than the Red Lobster, but I was just, you know how you get angry and you just kind of like just say, well, fuck it, I'll do this and I'll spend more money. I don't know. I just, you know, but I was riding high on a residual check. So you filmed this when? November of 2019?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did you two shows?
Yeah.
It's in one night?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, I couldn't afford. Yeah, the venue was really expensive. I couldn't afford to do it any other way.
We got
to
talk about that. And so you did two shows, and what did each show clock in? Because it's like what, 104? 104 is like the total time of the.
Yeah, and I didn't edit any material out or anything. So I get, you know, Jim Tews opened for me. So
cool.
He basically came. Yeah, he's the best.
So I love
he came
Jim.
Out, you know, told like 10 minutes of jokes, kind of was like, hey, everybody, keep your cell phones off. Don't be a dick.
That was him that brought you up? Who brought you?
No. So I had somebody do a ghost. So for the first show, my buddy, Prakash Peru, he's like one of my best friends from college, and he's a professional magician. He was the voice that you actually hear. And then for the second show, Hari Kondabolu did the voiceover. But I kept Prakash because he's who I
originally asked. He had to look, Prakash had to go run to a gig.
So I liked his voice. It was Liz Miley. The way he said it was like, I was like, Liz. I was like, all right, who's.
Yeah, he did the voice of God. Yeah, Prakash is the best. Yeah. You would love him. Very, very talented magician.
Cool.
So Jim just like warmed everybody up, made some announcements, and brought me on. And I didn't edit anything out. So that's exactly what the set was. Like there were some cuts and angles and stuff like that that needed to be fixed. And most of the show is the first show.
Okay.
I was better the first show. The audience was better the second show. So there was a little bit of taking the laughter from the second audience and influencing the first audience. But I would say about 85% of my performances from the first show.
Well, that's great, Liz. I mean, I appreciate what you do as a comedian, what you do, and even more. Like, I mean, you're funny, but then the drive, then the will and determination is just like, it's remarkable. Like, I admire you for that, and I hate to fucking say it, but I just like, you know, I have the safety of my day job, which is it's not really that safe. It's not that safe, but it's just like, I just even admire you more because it's like, this is what you do. You're eating off of this shit, and it's going to pay off. I mean, I just appreciate the way that you, invest in yourself. And,
thanks, dude.
I just
it does mean a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really remarkable. And you're funny, and you've actually gotten funnier. I know you've been doing it longer than me, but as somebody that knows a little bit about stand up, I just like to see the progress and the maturity and the it's just something that I just like how you open yourself up and you're not afraid to say what you want to say about yourself and about how things make you feel, like the self-awareness. I think it's just really, it's really good, Liz. It's really good.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
All right. Self-Help Me is a special. You can watch it on YouTube, share it, retweet it. It's available in audio form wherever you buy music. What else do you want to plug, Liz?
I have a podcast now because I'm not a comedian anymore. okay. You know how we've given up on our dreams because
my God, Liz, did you know that I was on Broadway right before the shutdown?
No.
Yeah. Yeah. I was.
Oh, buddy.
A dream that I never thought would happen. My listeners get tired of that shit. But yeah.
I fucking get it.
To think about
on and on.
When you were talking about the money, what's your podcast?
I was ready to make the most money I've ever made in my life. And it all went to shit. And I'm broker than I've ever been. I'm like, oh, peanut butter and jelly. I remember that.
Oh, fuck.
I started a podcast. I was in the middle of a European tour when everything went down with the pandemic, and okay. I had to cancel Germany and Switzerland and Sweden. And I was staying with my friend. Do you know Maria Shahada?
No, I know of her because of you. I just know her through pictures.
I think you guys missed each other a little bit. I started with her in New York, but then she was in LA for 8 years, and now she's been in London for 3 years. So she's my favorite person, one of my closest friends, and she stays with me all the time. I stay with her all the time. And so I was staying with her in London during my little London leg of my tour. And then everything had to get, and she was going to open for me all over Europe. She opened for me in Paris. She opened for me in London, and she was going to open for me for the rest of my tour. And then it all went to shit. So, I stayed with her for a couple of extra days because I had to change my flight.
Mm-hmm.
And we were kind of like, dude, I don't think we're going to be doing stand up for a while. And we always had this inside joke, about being non-doctors because we both give each other advice with no, literally no knowledge, but we're very confident, overconfident researchers, and we're also stubborn. So, you know, she would show me a rash and be like, do you think that's bad? And I was like, well, as a non-doctor, I think you should go to the emergency room. And she goes, well, as a non-doctor, I don't want to. And so we would get in like almost these like marital fights. And I told her, I was like, we should do a podcast together. I think we should actually do something with two non-doctors. And so we started planning it out as soon as I got home. And I think 2 days after I got home, we recorded our first episode, recorded about 7 of them, and then released 3 right away. So we have up to about 11, I think,
okay.
Posted.
And your mom's been on a couple or just one?
Yeah, my mom's been on two. We're actually going to record a third one with her this week. But basically, my mom is a veterinarian, but she's a competitive power lifter in her 60s. She started in her 60s. She's been competing in her 60s. So we had her come on and talk about weightlifting in her 60s, the power of weightlifting in general, weightlifting as a woman. It was, I think, one of our best episodes. The original one, she came on just as a veterinarian and what, I used to never go to the doctor as a kid. My mom and dad have sewn up each other, sewn up other kids. All my medicine, even today, says for cats and dogs only. So just what it was like to have a vet as a parent, and then what it's like to be a veterinarian and have your own education in being a doctor, and what it's like to be a doctor and veterinarian during the pandemic. And so the next one we're going to do with her is, my mom has done literally every exercise fad, and she's done every diet fad. So we're going to have two different ones where she talks about exercise fads since the 70s that she's done, which have worked, which haven't worked, the ones she's made up and shit like that. But yeah, she comes in and out and gives us really some validity, because me and Maria are morons. And at the end of every episode, we talk about what morons we are. But we're just researchers. We pick topics. Maria has misophonia. I have depression, dyslexia.
What's misophonia?
Anxiety. That's our first episode. Misophonia translates to the hatred of sound, but it's basically an irrational response to minor sounds. So she can't handle gum chewing. She can't handle toe tapping, pen clicking, other kind of things. And she's been like that for as long as I can remember. And I'm the one that actually diagnosed her about 5 years into our friendship. I read an article that it was like, this sounds like Maria. And I showed it to her, and it was like, and she found out there's other people like her. And now she's like, has like a whole system of how to not murder people for gum chewing. But it's like a real issue. It's a real issue. And some of the catalysts to us starting this is the same reason that even though you might not have OCD, you know what it is, or you might not have depression, you know what it is, or you might not have, what are some other weird ones? I don't know, Parkinson's. Like, there's certain things that you know of because celebrities have put it in the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
Maria has jokes about having misophonia, and it's our best episode. I think some of it's because it's our first one, but like, the misophonia community has been like, there's people that have written to us and been like, I think I have this. Holy shit. Like, my husband has hated me for years, and now I know it's a thing. Like, it's a real thing. Like, we've actually had a lot of people be like, thank you for talking about it. This makes so much sense. And, you know, it's really great how Liz is adapted, because, you know, I do a lot to make sure that Maria doesn't murder me or other people. I save a lot of lives, and nobody talks about it. Cause it's quite rageful how much she hates gum chewing. So it's just about talking about, our bodies, and you can cut this all out, but just like beauty, bodies, health, you know, all that stuff, and what we've learned and what we're trying to learn, and then kind of talking with our audience about it.
Good deal.
Two non-doctors.
You got a Patreon?
Yeah, we do have a Patreon. Be a Patreon person. $3. You can really help us.
Okay. There you go. Liz, this has been such a fucking pleasure to talk to you, as always.
You're a pleasure.
Hold on to the line. And guys, thanks so much for listening. Talk to you next time.